Find your niche. They are proficient in targeting market opportunities. Why is it that you're not wealthy? Perhaps it's because you are not pursuing opportunities that exist in the marketplace. There are significant business opportunities for those who target the affluent, the children of the affluent, and the widows and widowers of the affluent. Very often those who supply the affluent become wealthy themselves. Conversely, many people, including business owners, self-employed professionals, sales professionals, and even some salaried workers, never produce high incomes. Perhaps it's because their clients and customers have little or no money. But, you may say, you have told us that the affluent are often frugal. Why target those who are not big spenders? Why focus on people who are sensitive to the price variations in products and services? The affluent, especially the self-made affluent, are frugal and price-sensitive concerning many consumer products and services. But they are not nearly as price-sensitive when it comes to purchasing investment advice and services, accounting services, tax advice, legal services, medical and dental care for themselves and family members, educational products, and homes. Since the majority of the affluent are self-employed business owners and managers, they are also purchasers of industrial products and services. They are consumers of everything from office space to computer software. Also, the affluent are not at all frugal when it comes to buying products and services for their children and grandchildren. Nor are the children of the affluent frugal when it comes to spending the substantial gifts of cash that their parents and grandparents give them. Follow the money. In the next decade, there will be more wealth in this country than ever before. Opportunities to serve the wealthy will be greater than ever. Consider these facts about the American economy. In 1996, approximately 3.5 million households in America, out of a total of 100 million households, had a net worth of $1 million or more. Millionaire households accounted for nearly half of all private wealth in America. During the 10-year period from 1996 through 2005, wealth held by American households is expected to grow nearly six times faster than the household population. By the year 2005, the total net worth of American households will be $27.7 trillion, or more than 20% higher than in 1996. By 2005, the millionaire household population is expected to reach approximately 5.6 million. At that time, the majority of the private wealth in America, $16.3 trillion of the $27.7 trillion, or approximately 59%, will be held by the 5.3% of households that have a net worth of $1 million or more. During the period from 1996 through 2005, it is estimated that 692,493 decedents will leave estates worth $1 million or more. This translates into $2.1 trillion in 1990 constant dollars. About one-third of this amount will be distributed to the decedent's spouses, in 80% of these cases widows. Widows will receive an estimated $560.2 billion, while the children of decedents will receive nearly $400 billion. This translates into $189,484 for each of the estimated 2,077,490 children of decedents. People who receive wealth from the estates of affluent parents have a significantly higher propensity to spend than others in their income/age cohort. Additionally, to minimize estate taxes, many affluent parents reduce the size of their estates by transferring much of their wealth to their offspring before death. During the 10-year period 1996 to 2005, it is forecasted that living parents and grandparents will give their adult children and grandchildren more than $1 trillion. These gifts will be in various forms, including cash, collectibles, homes, cars, commercial real estate, public securities, and mortgage payments. This $1 trillion in gifts translates into more than $600,000 in constant 1990 dollars for each child of the affluent. This $1 trillion figure is a very conservative estimate, since, as stated earlier, by the year 2005, households in America with a net worth of $1 million or more will account for $16.3 trillion, or 59%, of the personal wealth in America. The $1 trillion given to children and grandchildren thus represents a small portion, 6.3%, of this wealth. Much of this gift-giving is tax-free. Typically, parents distribute their wealth so as to limit gift tax liabilities. Each parent can give each child and grandchild up to $10,000 annually. Thus, a mother and father with three children and six grandchildren can give them $180,000 tax-free each year. Also note that gifts of tuition and medical expenses are typically not included in computations of gift tax liability. Businesses and professions likely to benefit from the affluent. There are many. Those who are specialists in solving the problems of the affluent and their heirs should be in great demand during the next 20 years. Attorneys who specialize. A father recently asked us about the ideal occupation for his son. At the time of this discussion, his son was a second-year college student with a straight-A average. How did the father respond when we suggested that his son consider becoming an attorney? He said there were too many attorneys. We replied that there were too many law school graduates. There is always a demand for high-grade attorneys. Attorneys who can generate new business are in even higher demand. The father asked about the areas of law that would be best suited for his son. We described three to him. Estate attorneys. Too many? The first area we recommended was estate law. During the 10-year period from 1996 to 2005, attorneys' fees associated with settling estates in the $1 million or more category will total an estimated $17.1 billion. Many attorneys will also earn revenue by acting as executors or co-executors as well as administrators of estates. Attorneys will participate as executors or administrators for only a fraction of the estates worth $1 million and more. But even a fraction of the estimated $22.3 billion in executors' fees and $16.9 billion in administrators' fees translates into high profits for enlightened estate attorneys. In essence, estate attorneys will likely generate more than $25 billion in revenue from servicing estates in the $1 million or more range during the 1996 to 2005 period. This figure is greater than the net income generated by all law partnerships for all services in 1994. Of course, this total is only a small amount compared with the nearly $270 billion that will be paid to the federal government in estate taxes during the same 10-year period. There is more to being a successful estate attorney than just providing legal advice. The more successful ones also act as mentors and family advisors to the affluent and their heirs. These attorneys have to be especially adept at meeting the needs of the widows and widowers who are their clients. Within the affluent married couple population, almost all husbands and wives intend to leave their estates to their spouses, since a husband or wife can inherit his or her spouse's estate without paying an estate tax. This unlimited marital deduction essentially postpones payment of estate taxes until the death of the second spouse. Affluent widows face a particularly difficult situation. More than half will have been married to the same spouse for more than 50 years. Between 1996 and 2005, there are likely to be four affluent widows created for every one affluent widower. Age is most significant in explaining this variation. Within the millionaire married couple population, the expected average age of a male decedent or husband is 75 and a half years, while the average age for a female decedent or wife is 82 years. Moreover, males in such cases typically marry women who are on average 2 years their junior. Thus, in the typical affluent couple population, the husband who passes away at the age of 75 and a half years leaves behind a widow who is 2 years younger than he was at the time of death. His wife, who became a widow at the age of 73, is expected to live until she is 82. Most women in this scenario never remarry. Therefore, most women are widowed for 9 years before their deaths. It is estimated that during the 10-year period from 1996 to 2005, nearly 296,000 women in the millionaire married couple population will become widows. Their average inheritance will be approximately $2 million, in $1990. During this same period, nearly 72,000 men from this population will become widowers. It is estimated that these men will inherit more than $125 billion, or an average inheritance of approximately $1.7 million. In what states will the demand for estate attorneys be the strongest? We predict that demand in California, Florida, New York, Illinois, Texas, and Pennsylvania will be especially high during the next decade. On income and/or wealth. Which is the number one income-consuming category among the affluent? Income tax. The affluent in the $200,000 and more annual realized income category account for only about 1% of U.S. households but pay 25% of the tax on personal income. They will want to become better at realizing less income in the future. What will happen in the year 2005 when millionaire households will control 59% of America's personal wealth? The government will likely place increased pressure on the affluent, possibly by creating innovative ways to tax wealth in addition to income. This prospect, according to our surveys of millionaires, is foremost on the minds of the affluent. Paying increasingly higher taxes to cover government spending and reduce the federal deficit is among the greatest fears of the affluent population. Several states already have a wealth tax. Each year, residents in such states must list all the financial assets they own. A tax is levied on stocks, bonds, time deposits, and so on. How difficult would it be for our federal government to tax wealth this way? Not too difficult, since it already knows how some states tax capital before it becomes realized income. We believe that in the next 20 years, the affluent will have to use every option within the law to remain affluent. It is a segment of our economy that will be under siege by the liberal politician and his friend, the taxman. Surely the affluent will readily spend their money for legal advice that will help them withstand the siege. The tax attorney will prove to be an integral part of the defense. Thus, the second area of law we recommended to the father for his son was tax law. For sale, a place in America. The third area of law we recommended was immigration law. Attorneys who specialize in immigration law are likely to benefit from predicted developments in this area. For example, it will become progressively more difficult to immigrate to this country and become a naturalized citizen. At the same time, the demand for American citizenship will increase greatly, especially among affluent foreigners. Consider how millionaire entrepreneurs and advocates of free enterprise living in Taiwan feel about their future. China also wants their capital and country. China wants the Philippines for its oil. Who can guess how the Chinese government will treat the affluent population of a country it acquires? China is a real threat to many affluent people who live within its influence. Many of these people will seek American citizenship. Immigration attorneys will surely benefit from this trend. Darrell Fears wrote in the April 27, 1996 issue of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, "People do not feel safe," said Chris Chang of the Taiwan-based Pan-Pacific Immigration Company. "They want to come to the USA. Billions of dollars have flowed out of Taiwan since mainland China held naval maneuvers off the island's coast. China considers Taiwan a renegade province." The fear of affluent Taiwanese business owners is reflected in their movement of money into America. In fact, they recently invested more than $10 billion in California alone. Now they are considering investing $50 million in Atlanta. What do they get for investing in this country? In an April 11, 1996 article in the Wall Street Journal, John R. Emshwiller noted that the Million Dollar Investor Program was created by Congress in 1990. It allows foreign nationals to attain permanent U.S. residency if they invest $1 million in a U.S. business, provided that investment creates 10 jobs. The need for immigration-related legal expertise is not limited to foreigners who are affluent entrepreneurs. Many highly skilled professionals and scientific workers are being sought in growing numbers by American corporations. These employees have an increasing need for the services of attorneys who have considerable expertise and experience with immigration statutes. Medical and dental care specialists. Many specialists will benefit from the enormous number of dollars that the affluent population will spend for health care in the next decade. A growing number of wealthy people will pay for the medical and dental expenses of their adult children and grandchildren. Currently, more than 4 in 10 millionaires are paying or have paid for the medical and dental expenses of their adult offspring and or grandchildren. We estimate that in the next 10 years, millionaires will spend in excess of $52 billion for the medical and dental care of their adult children and grandchildren. Most of these medical and dental expenses are not covered by health care insurance programs. Skilled health care specialists, who prefer to deal directly with individual payers and not with bureaucratic third-party organizations, will be especially important in providing these uncovered services. A growing number of health care professionals are already focusing on this affluent, self-payer market. Those professionals with the highest skills and corresponding reputations can most readily capitalize on this trend. Often they can demand and receive fees that are higher than any insurance company would be willing to pay. The affluent will often pay directly to the healthcare professional or organization. This way they avoid the possibility of paying gift tax on such distributions. Also, many affluent people will pay for their own elective healthcare services. Specialists who will benefit include dentists providing cosmetic dentistry, including bleaching, bonding, veneers, invisible braces, cosmetic nasal surgery, and chin and corrective jaw surgery. Plastic surgeons providing nose reshaping surgery, ear reshaping surgery, tattoo removal, facial contouring, chemical peels, and permanent hair removal. Dermatologists providing mole removal, cosmetic surgery, acne treatment, freckle removal, and electrolysis. Allergists providing treatment for fatigue, rashes, hives, itching, allergy-related mood swings and depression, food allergies, learning disabilities, and Newhouse sickness. Psychologists providing career counseling, academic and career assessment, treatments for attention deficit disorder, treatment for compulsive eating disorder, shyness, and assertiveness conditioning, and intelligence and aptitude testing. Psychiatrists providing treatment for stress and anxiety, drug and alcohol abuse, school stress, and panic disorders. Chiropractors providing treatment for stress relief and head, neck, and lower back pain. Asset liquidators, facilitators, and appraisers. Not all intergenerational gifts are in the form of cash or its equivalents. Gifts to adult children and grandchildren are often in the form of private family businesses, coin collections, stamp collections, gems and precious metals, timberland, farms, rights to oil and gas properties, personal real estate, commercial real estate, gun collections, porcelains, antiques, art, motor vehicles, furniture, and the like. Often the recipients of these items have little or no interest in them and want to transform them into cash immediately. They will need experts to advise them of the true value of the gifts, or how to sell them, manage them even for short periods of time, or enhance their value. Specialists who will benefit include appraisers and auctioneers providing valuation, appraisal services, and sales of a variety of personal and other assets, such as those just mentioned. Coin and stamp dealers providing appraisal services and, in some cases, instant cash for coin and stamp collection. Pawnbrokers providing services at the local level. They often promote themselves as specialists in purchasing estate jewelry, diamonds, precious metals, coins, guns, antiques, china, collectibles, expensive watches, sterling flatware, and so on. Real estate management professionals providing property management of single and or multiple family dwellings, maintenance services, rent collection, and turnkey cleanup. Educational institutions and professionals. More than 40% of America's affluent pay for their grandchildren's private grade school and or high school tuition. Coupled with the rapid growth of the affluent population, this translates into several million students whose tuition to attend private school will be subsidized within the next 10 years. Given these facts, the demand for private school facilities and private school teachers, counselors, and tutors will likely accelerate. At the same time, tuition and related expenses should increase significantly. Why? Because affluent grandparents are bidding up the cost of private school tuition. since many of their adult children do not have to pay for the services from which their children benefit. The parents are relatively insensitive to the escalating cost of a private school education. Organizations and specialists who will benefit include proprietors and teachers at private schools that provide tuition-based education at the preschool, kindergarten, elementary, and high school levels. Proprietors and teachers in specialized areas, such as music, drama, the arts, special education, learning disability programs, career counseling, and tutorials for SAT and other types of entrance and aptitude tests. Professional services specialists. As stated previously, attorneys play a pivotal role in the transfer of wealth between generations. Accountants are also important in this regard. These professionals often serve as key advisors to the affluent. Advice in this context extends beyond the normal core of accounting and legal services. These professionals are relied on for their insights into how best to distribute substantial financial and other gifts to children and grandchildren. Clients often view these accountants as their first line of defense against paying substantial gift and estate taxes. They are often called upon to be co-executors of the estates of their affluent clients. It is not unusual for co-executors in these situations to receive a percentage of the estates of their clients. This is one way the affluent reward these trusted advisors for a lifetime of sage advice. Specialists who will benefit include accountants providing tax planning strategies, estate, trust, and gift tax solutions, fiduciary services, business asset valuation, and retirement planning. Housing specialists, dwelling products, services. More than half the affluent population will provide their offspring with financial assistance in purchasing a home. This figure actually understates the incidence of such outpatient care because often other substantial financial gifts not earmarked for specific use are used for home purchases and related expenses. Those who receive home acquisition subsidies from their relatives are often less sensitive to the variations in home prices than the non-subsidized. As always, our data suggests that it is easier to spend other people's money. This trend should benefit many of those who are employed in the residential housing and mortgage lending businesses. Home acquisition subsidies typically do not negate the need for credit. Actually, parents who provide part of the purchase price of a home often precipitate the purchase of more expensive homes and larger mortgages on the part of their sons and daughters. Specialists who will benefit include home building contractors, mortgage lenders, remodeling contractors, renovation contractors, residential real estate developers, residential real estate agents, retailers of paint, wall coverings, and decorating products, marketers of alarm and security systems and security consultation services, providers of interior design and decorating services. Fundraising counselors. Specialists who will benefit include professionals who conduct philanthropic research, develop targeting strategies, and counsel foundations and educational institutions. Travel agents and bureaus and travel consultants. The affluent enjoy vacationing with their children and grandchildren, and many of the affluent spend considerable amounts doing so. About 55% recently spent more than $5,000 for a vacation. About 1 in 6 spent in excess of $10,000. Specialists who will benefit include marketers of family-oriented vacation resorts, marketers of cruises, tours, worldwide vacations, and treks and safaris. Where are the opportunities likely to be? People who are interested in targeting the wealthy need to know the geographic distribution of the opportunities available. Note that earlier we provided estimates by state of the number and total dollar value of estates in the $1 million or more category. But keep in mind that for every estate in the $1 million or more category, there are about 40 millionaires who are still alive. Thus, for many people who wish to market to the affluent, living millionaires are the more important of the two groups. With this in mind, we have estimated how many U.S. households will have a net worth of $1 million or more in the year 2005. We have also estimated how many of these households there will be in each of the 50 states, the District of Columbia, and among Americans living outside the U.S. California has the largest millionaire household population. In terms of concentration per 100,000 households, however, Connecticut ranks first. Jobs. Millionaires versus heirs. They chose the right occupation. About 10 years ago, a reporter from a national news magazine called. She asked the question we are most frequently asked. Who are the affluent? By now, you probably can predict the answer. Most of the affluent in America are business owners, including self-employed professionals. 20% of the affluent households in America are headed by retirees. Of the remaining 80%, more than two-thirds are headed by self-employed owners of businesses. In America, fewer than one in five households, or about 18%, is headed by a self-employed business owner or professional. But these self-employed people are four times more likely to be millionaires than those who work for others. The reporter followed with the next logical question. What types of businesses do millionaires own? Our answer was the same one we give everyone. You can't predict if someone is a millionaire by the type of business he's in. After 20 years of studying millionaires across a wide spectrum of industries, we have concluded that the character of the business owner is more important in predicting his level of wealth than the classification of his business. But no matter how hard we try to make our point, reporters want to keep things simple. What a great story, what a great headline it would make if they could tell readers, here are 10 businesses millionaires own. We've gone out of our way to emphasize that there are no sure steps one can take to become wealthy. Too often, reporters ignore the facts. They sensationalize and twist our research findings. Yes, you are more likely to become affluent if you're self-employed. But what some of these reporters don't tell you is that most business owners are not millionaires and will never come close to becoming wealthy. We do tell reporters that some industries tend to be more profitable than others. Thus, those who own businesses in the more profitable industries tend, by definition, to realize more income. But just because you're in a profitable industry does not guarantee that your business will be highly productive. And even if your business is highly productive, you may never become wealthy. Why? Because even if you earn big profits, you may spend even bigger amounts on non-business-related consumer goods and services. You may have been divorced three times or have a habit of gambling on the horses. You may not have a pension plan or own any shares in quality, publicly traded corporations. Perhaps you feel little need to accumulate wealth. Money, in your mind, may be the most easily renewable resource. If you think it is, you may be a spender and never an investor. But what if you're frugal and a conscientious investor and you own a business that is profitable? In this case, you're likely to become wealthy. It is easier to earn higher profits in some industries than others. Shortly, we will identify several of these profitable industries. But again, we caution you not to oversimplify our findings and suggestions. Too often, people want a soundbite answer to the question of how to become wealthy in America. Even worse are those who distort our data-based findings. Consider, along these lines, the message that was recently left for us by a business broker. He said, I thought you would like to know that someone has printed a brochure stating that you are a professor at Stanford University and that you found that 20% of the millionaires in America are dry cleaners. Is this true? First, neither one of us ever taught at Stanford. Second, neither of us has ever stated that one in five millionaires is at this moment pressing shirts. We did find, in the mid-1980s, that dry cleaning was a profitable small business industry. But again, profits don't automatically translate into affluence or accumulated wealth. This is like those sons of ours and perhaps yours who thought they would make the varsity basketball team because they bought a pair of Air Jordan shoes. A label does not make a varsity player, nor does an industry label make the business owner wealthy. It takes talent and discipline to generate profits and ultimately wealth. That is why we are offended by people who tell the American public, just buy my educational study-at-home kit and your new business venture will be a success. Start your own business today, you will be wealthy tomorrow. I did it in this industry, you can do it too, it's so easy. Again, it's not the kit, not the idea, not the industry. For example, the profitability data for hardware lumber retail establishments 25 years ago never got us excited. They didn't convince us to invest in a business of this type. But think what the founders of the highly profitable Home Depot did. They reinvented the industry. They did not allow industry standards for profits, sales volume, or overhead to dictate how they operated their business and invested their money. These founders had tremendous talent, discipline, and courage. They became wealthy and helped make a lot of their employees and other investors financially independent. Most people who make it big in business set their own very high standards. Only change is predictable. Things do change, even in the so-called owner-manager business environment. Take, for example, the industry we mentioned previously, dry cleaning. In fact, the appropriate title is Laundries, Dry Cleaning, and Garment Services. With regard to this industry, Dr. Tom Stanley reported in his 1988 book, Marketing to the Affluent, in 1984, there were 6,940 partnerships. 91.9% have net income, while the average return on receipts, net profit as a percent of receipts, was 23.4%. What about the profitability of this industry in the 1990s? We analyzed the IRS's federal income tax return data. In 1992, we determined that there were 4,615 partnerships. Only 50.5% had any net income, while the average return on receipts was 13%. Also, in 1992, there were 24,186 sole proprietorship dry cleaners in America. What was their average net income? On average, it was $5,360. This placed dry cleaners 116th out of 171 sole proprietorships based on average net income criteria. The industry at that time ranked 119th in return on receipts, which equaled 8.1%. What percentage of dry cleaners generated a net income? Nearly 3 in 4, or 74.1%, made at least $1 of net income. In this regard, dry cleaning ranked 92 out of 171 industries analyzed. What a difference 8 short years can make. But the dry cleaning industry is not the only one to encounter such changes. The number of men's and boys' clothing and furnishing stores, for example, more than doubled from 1984 to 1992. In 1984, all of the sole proprietorships in that industry made a profit. But in 1992, only 82.7% were profitable. Its rank in this regard dropped from first to 57th. Among the 171 sole proprietorships studied. The highway and street construction contractors industry moved from a ranking of 8 to 138, while coal mining moved from 14 to 165. Many external and often uncontrollable factors influence the profitability of industries and firms within those industries. Often the presence of high numbers of profitable firms within an industry attracts more and more people to the industry, which can have a dampening effect on profits. Changes in consumer preferences can also affect profits. So can the actions of our government. If it had an energy policy that favored the use of coal, perhaps the number of sole proprietorship coal mining businesses would not have dropped from 717 to 76 in just 8 years. Only 34.2% of the 76 coal mining businesses made a net profit, but in spite of this, sole proprietorships in this business earned an average net income of $196,618. Obviously, a minority of coal mining operations owners ignore industry trends and standards, and many of these people have been rewarded for their tenacity and contrary beliefs about the coal industry. Many successful business owners have told us that they enjoy short periods of rough times in their chosen industries because they weed out much of the competition. This seems to be the case in the coal mining industry. the 34.2% of the businesses in the industry that were profitable had a net income of approximately $600,000. Many people ask us, should I go into business for myself? Most people have no business ever working for themselves. The average net income for the more than 15 million sole proprietorships in America is only $6,200. About 25% of sole proprietorships do not make 1 cent of profit during a typical year. It's even worse for partnerships. 42% on average make no profits in a year. What about corporations? Only 55% have any taxable income during a typical 12-month period. Self-employed professionals versus other business owners. Fewer than 1 in 5 millionaire business owners turns his business over to his children to own and operate. Why? Give credit to wealthy parents. They know the odds of succeeding in business. They understand that most businesses are highly susceptible to competition, counter-consumer trends, high overhead, and other uncontrollable variables. So what do these millionaires advise their children to do? They encourage their children to become self-employed professionals, such as physicians, attorneys, engineers, architects, accountants, and dentists. As stated earlier, millionaire couples with children are 5 times more likely to send their children to medical school than other parents in America, and about 4 times more likely to send them to law school. The affluent know the risks and the odds of succeeding or failing in business. They also seem to understand that only a small minority of self-employed professionals fail to make a profit in any given year, and that the profitability of most professional service firms is substantially higher than the average for small businesses in general. We will elaborate on these issues with hard numbers. But first, let's discuss the other attributes associated with being a self-employed professional. For a moment, assume you are Mr. Carl Johnson, the sole proprietor of Johnson Coal. You're the owner of one of the 26 coal mining businesses that made a profit last year out of the 76 in the industry. Not long ago, 717 sole proprietors were still in your industry. More than 9 of every 10 made a profit. Now the industry has been reduced in number by 90%. But you're tough, you're resourceful, and you're intelligent. In spite of the withdrawal of most of the other operators, you hung in there. Now you're reaping the benefits. You made a net profit of $600,000 last year, and you're doing well this year. Now you have 2 children in college who are outstanding students. You begin to ask yourself some questions. Should I encourage my David and Christy to become involved in the coal mining business? Should I encourage them to eventually take over my parents' coal mine? Is coal mining the best place for my children? Most of the millionaire business owners we have interviewed would not encourage their children to take over such a business. This is especially true in cases in which the children are outstanding students. They would suggest that David and Christy, the young scholars, consider other avenues. Most businesses today require some investment in land, equipment, and buildings. The Johnson coal mining business owns mountains that contain coal. It owns millions of dollars worth of equipment. It employs many miners and must constantly upgrade the safety of its operation. It must conform to OSHA's mandates. It must deal with the uncontrollable price the market places on a ton of coal. It must constantly be vigilant about competitors who are trying to steal its customers. It must keep a careful watch on changes in America's energy policy. It also must keep its workers happy and safe. It must constantly deal with the possibility of a mine cave-in and halted production. Finally, the operation is in a fixed location. Mountains can't be moved to a warmer climate or closer to a more efficient railroad operation. What happens if there is a prolonged railroad strike? Ask yourself these questions. If you do, you will soon realize you're in a precarious position. So what if you run a superior operation? The uncontrollable factors outlined above can kill your business. Given these considerations, that $600,000 you earned last year seems smaller. How many $600,000 years are in your future? What if the uncontrollable factors drive you bankrupt next year? Can you use your skills to teach coal mining at the technical university? Probably not. Your skills are more hands-on, not intellectual. We once asked an affluent business owner who had fled Europe because of the Holocaust why all his adult children were self-employed professionals. His response? They can take your business, but they can't take your intellect. What does this mean? A government and/or a creditor can confiscate a business composed of land, machinery, coal pits, buildings, and so on. It can't confiscate your intellect. What do professionals sell? Not coal, not paint, not even pizza. What they sell most of all is their intellect. Physicians, for example, can take their intellect anywhere in America. Their resources are quite portable. The same is true for dentists, attorneys, accountants, engineers, architects, veterinarians, and chiropractors. These are the occupations held by a disproportionate number of the sons and daughters of affluent couples throughout America. What about the income characteristics of professionals, as compared with the Johnson coal mining operation? Only a minority of self-employed professionals have ever made as much as $600,000 profit in a single year. And most self-employed professionals spend many years in training, which is costly both in dollars and time. Nevertheless, most affluent parents believe that the lifetime benefits associated with being a professional greatly outweigh the costs. Remember, most of these parents pay all or a significant portion of their sons and daughters' tuition and fees for training. Their vote is with their hard-earned money. How will you vote? Coal mining, on average, produced a higher net income, $196,600, than other sole proprietorships, such as physicians' offices, dentists' offices, optometrists' offices, bowling centers, chiropractors' offices, drugstores, legal services, and veterinarians' offices. But what proportion of coal mining operations made any net income during the same period of time? Only about 1 in 3. What businesses were profitable? About 87.2% of the offices of physicians, 94.9% of the offices of dentists, 92.5% of the offices of veterinarians, and 86.6% of the offices providing legal services. Also examine the average return on receipts. It would take $2.4 million in receipts for a coal mining operation on average to generate a net income of $196,600. What about physicians? The average net income of a physician's office is $87,000. That's 56.2% of the $154,804 receipts generated. With that kind of return on receipts, how many dollars in receipts would a physician's office have to generate to earn the same average net income that coal mining businesses earned? Only $349,800. A far cry from the $2.4 million required of coal mining operations. The figure's even lower for osteopathic physicians. On average, they require receipts of $340,138 to earn the expected $196,600 in net income. Legal service providers, on average, would need to generate $414,800 in sales to earn what the average coal mine operation earned in net income. What will you advise David and Christy to do? If you're like most successful business owners, you will advise them to become professionals. So it is with the affluent in America. The first-generation affluent are typically entrepreneurs. They beat the odds. Their businesses succeed, and they become affluent. Much of their success depends on their living a frugal existence while building their businesses. Luck is often involved. And most who succeed understand that circumstances could have gone against them. Their children will have it better. They will not have to take significant risks. They will be well educated. They will become physicians, attorneys, and accountants. Their capital is their intellect. But unlike their parents, they will postpone entering the job market until they are in their late 20s or even their early 30s. And most likely, they will adopt an upper middle class lifestyle as soon as they start working. A much different lifestyle than their frugal parents had when they started their businesses. Often their children are not frugal. How could they be? They have high status positions that require higher levels of consumption and thus lower levels of investing. As a consequence, they may require economic outpatient care. In spite of earning high incomes, as most professionals do, they are obligated to spend. Thus, because there are corresponding high levels of household spending requirements for many high-income producing categories of business, it is difficult to predict levels of wealth based on the income characteristics of various types of businesses. Dull normal businesses and the affluent. A recent article by Fleming Meeks and David S. Fomdiller in Forbes had an interesting lead. Dull companies with steady earnings growth may not make for stimulating cocktail party chatter, but over the long term they make the best investments. Later in the same article, the authors mention that in the long run, high-tech companies can, and often do, fall down on the performance scale. Typically, it's the companies in what we call the dull normal industries that consistently perform well for their owners. Forbes lists several top-performing small businesses that have had great endurance for the past 10 years. Some of the industries represented include wallboard manufacturing, building material manufacturing, electronics stores, prefab housing, and automobile parts. No, these industries don't sound very exciting. But typically, it's these mundane categories of businesses that produce wealth for their owners. Often, dull normal industries don't attract a great deal of competition, and demand for their offerings is not usually subject to rapid downturns. We recently developed our own list of businesses that are owned by millionaires. We would like to list just a sample at this juncture. Advertising specialty distributors, ambulance service, apparel manufacturer ready-to-wear, auctioneer or appraiser, cafeteria owner, citrus fruits farmer, coin and stamp dealership, consulting geologist, cotton ginning, diesel engine rebuilder or distributor, donut maker machine manufacturer, engineering and design, fundraiser, heat transfer equipment manufacturer, human resources consulting services, industrial chemicals cleaning and sanitation manufacturer, janitorial services contractor, job training and vocational tech school owner, long-term care facilities, meat processor, mobile home park owner, newsletter publisher, office temp recruiting service, pest control services, physicist inventor, public relations or lobbyist, rice farmer, sandblasting contractor. What businesses do the affluent own? A wide variety of dull normals. Risk or freedom? Why do people operate their own businesses? First, most successful business owners will tell you that they have tremendous freedom. They are their own bosses. Also, they tell us that self-employment is less risky than working for others. A professor once asked a group of 60 MBA students who were executives of public corporations this question: what is risk? One student replied, being an entrepreneur. His fellow students agreed. Then the professor answered his own question with a quote from an entrepreneur. What is risk? Having one source of income. Employees are at risk. They have a single source of income. What about the entrepreneur who sells janitorial services to your employers? He has hundreds and hundreds of customers, hundreds and hundreds of sources of income. Actually, there is considerable financial risk in being a business owner. But business owners have a set of beliefs that helps them reduce their risk, or at least their perceived risk. I'm in control of my own destiny. Risk is working for a ruthless employer. I can solve any problem. The only way to become a CEO is to own the company. There are no limits on the amount of income I can make. I get stronger and wiser every day by facing risk and adversity. To be a business owner also requires that you have the desire to be self-employed. If you hate the thought of being outside the corporate environment, entrepreneurship may not be your calling. The most successful business owners we have interviewed have one characteristic in common. They all enjoy what they do. They all take pride in going it alone. Consider what a multimillionaire once told us about being self-employed. There are more people, employees, today working at jobs that they don't like. I'll tell you honestly that the successful man is a guy who works at a job, who likes his work, who can't wait to get up in the morning and get down to the office. And that's my criteria. and I've always been that way. I can't wait to get up and get down to the office and get my job underway. For this fellow, a widower without children, it's not the money. In fact, his estate plan calls for all his wealth to go to the undergraduate scholarship fund at his alma mater. How did this fellow and others like him select the businesses they wanted to start? He was well trained in college by engineering and science professors, many of whom were also entrepreneurs. These professors were his role models. Most successful business owners had some knowledge or experience with their chosen industry before they ever opened their own businesses. Larry, for example, worked for more than a dozen years selling printing services. He was the top performer for his employer. But after growing tired of the constant fear that his employer would go bankrupt, he considered opening his own printing company. He sought our advice in this regard. We asked Larry a simple question. What's the number one thing that printing companies need? He immediately responded, more business, more revenue, more customers. Thus, Larry answered his own question. He did start his own business, but not his own printing company. He became a self-employed broker of printing services. He now represents several outstanding printing firms and receives a commission on every sale he makes. His business has little overhead. Before starting his own business, Larry told us he did not have the courage to be an entrepreneur. He told us that every time he even thought about going it alone, he encountered fear. Larry believed that the self-employed were fearless, that fear never entered their minds. We had to help Larry adjust his thinking. We began by explaining that his definition of courage was wrong. How do we define courage? Courage is behaving in a way that conjures up fear. Yes, Larry, courageous people, entrepreneurs, recognize the fear in what they are doing. But they deal with it. They overcome their fears. That's why they are successful. We have spent a considerable amount of time studying courageous people. Certainly, Ray Kroc had enormous courage to think he could market food to the world. Remember that he was an ambulance driver on the front lines in World War I. So was Walt Disney. Lee Iacocca had to have enormous courage to tell Congress and the world that Chrysler would come back big time. He does not fit the strict definition of an entrepreneur, but in our minds he has entrepreneurial blood in his veins. Fear abounds in America, but according to our research, who has less fear and worry? Would you guess it's the person with the $5 million trust account or the self-made entrepreneur worth several million dollars? Typically, it's the entrepreneur, the person who deals with risk every day, who tests his or her courage every day. In this way, he learns to conquer fear. We saved the following case study for last because in our minds it encapsulates the differences between PAWs and UAWs. Throughout this program, we have stressed that the members of these two groups have distinctly different needs. PAWs need to achieve, to create wealth, to become financially independent, to build something from scratch. UAWs more often need to display a high-status lifestyle. What happens when members of these two groups attempt to occupy the same space at the same time? As the following case study demonstrates, the likely result is conflict. Mr. W. is a self-made millionaire with a net worth conservatively estimated to be over $30 million. A typical PAW, Mr. W., is the owner of several companies that produce industrial equipment, testing instruments, and specialty gauges. He is also involved in many other entrepreneurial activities, including real estate ventures. Mr. W. lives in a middle-class neighborhood surrounded by people who have only a small fraction of the wealth he has accumulated. He and his wife drive full-size General Motors sedans. His living and consuming habits are quite middle-class. He never wears a tie or suit to work. Mr. W. enjoys venturing into, as he calls it, luxury real estate. I make money outside of the equipment business, in real estate. God continues to make more people, but he doesn't make any more land. You will make money if you're smart, and you're choosy where you pick the spot. Mr. W. is very picky indeed. He buys property outright or in partnership only when the price is right. He typically purchases property or a part ownership from an owner and/or a developer who is in great need of financial assistance. Recently, he uncovered yet another superior investment opportunity in Sun Country. Some poor guy was putting together a luxury high-rise condominium. For a builder to build, he had to have 50% of the units sold. So I went in and made a deal with him. I bought all of the units of the same style, floor plan, with a lot of leverage, and he got his money. And he built, because I bought all the one style. Anybody who wanted to buy that style had to see me. Like Monopoly, nobody else competes with me. I sell them all right out, all but one. But Mr. W. does not even keep the one remaining unit for very long. He and his family use it for a short vacation or two. Occasionally, he invites his close friends to use it. Otherwise, he rents the remaining unit until it is sold. Why doesn't Mr. W. maintain a more permanent presence in these condominium complexes? It's not his style. Most of the people who buy Mr. W.'s vacation condominiums are upper-middle-class UAWs. Mr. W. and many of the buyers of his condominium units have had a number of disagreements. In several of the complexes where Mr. W. previously bought units, his buyers passed so many restrictive covenants that Mr. W. was uncomfortable even spending vacation time in his condominiums. Thus, he felt compelled to sell that one remaining unit in each of these complexes. I have a dog. Call him the six-figure doggie. I have sold several condominiums because the people passed dog laws. They told me, you know, you've got to get rid of the dog. I'll sell an entire building before I get rid of my dog. Mr. W. anticipated that the status-conscious buyers of his latest venture would also be insensitive to his desire to have a dog. So before construction on the complex was even started, he listed his dog in the building's declaration. It stated that Mr. W. and his family would have the right to have a dog with them when they were in residence. All the buyers, according to Mr. W., were given copies of the declaration. Thus, they were all aware of Mr. W.'s right to have a dog in the complex. Not one owner objected at the time they purchased property. But shortly after the complex was completely sold out, excluding Mr. W.'s last available unit, the owners banded together and formed an action committee. Its purpose was to develop and enforce an expanded list of restrictive covenants. Certainly, these new covenants would not restrict the rights of Mr. W. and his dog. After all, these rights were specified in the original declaration. The action committee passed a dog law. It sidestepped the original declaration concerning dogs and stated that dogs would be allowed on the complex with certain restrictions if they weighed less than 15 pounds. So much for doggy rights and original declarations. Mr. W. felt that this was a subterfuge to encourage him to sell out. His six-figure doggy weighed 30 pounds. He felt that even if the dog dieted, it would not come into compliance. Mr. W. was particularly disturbed that he was never allowed to cast a vote for or against the dog-related covenant. Nonetheless, he was determined to keep his dog in spite of the covenant. After all, he had been a major investor in the building before construction even began. The action committee wrote me a letter and stated that I had to get rid of the dog because it was over 15 pounds. So I went to one of their meetings. I complained about their voting system. I had no representation. Just prior to leaving the meeting, Mr. W. addressed the committee. How do you know he's over 15 pounds? How do you know he could be hollow? I won't get rid of the dog. A few days after the meeting, the head of the action committee cornered Mrs. W. while she was walking her dog. He told her in a legalese tone, "Get rid of the dog. You're in violation of our covenant." Later that afternoon, Mrs. W. told her husband what had transpired. She was noticeably upset about the encounter. He advised her to stay calm. Several weeks later, Mr. W. received a letter that demanded that he remove his dog. It also stated that legal action would be initiated if he did not comply with the dog-related covenant. Two more letters followed. Each contained statements that were even more threatening than the first. Mr. W. was not impressed with these requests. The author of the letters was the chairman of the action committee. He was also an attorney. But as Mr. W. discovered, the chairman was not licensed to practice law in the state where the complex was located. Thus, Mr. W. promptly ignored each of the action committee's demands. However, Mr. W. and his family began to feel that they were out of place even just vacationing at this condominium complex. Was the action committee using the dog as leverage to evict his entire family? Mr. W. was convinced this was the real issue. He and his family were not what some would consider to be beautiful people. In contrast, the complex was filled with, in Mr. W.'s parlance, the best scrubbed condominium owners one could ever imagine. Mr. W. was growing increasingly angry with the members of the Action Committee. He felt that its members were going out of their way to be rude to him. He was especially annoyed that the chairman of the committee had embarrassed his wife in front of several other condominium owners. Mr. W. devised a plan. At a meeting of the condominium owners, at which all the members of the Action Committee were present, Mr. W. stood up and introduced himself. "I'm the guy that you have been sending letters to about our dog. I have given your proposal some careful consideration. I've decided I'm not going to get rid of my dog, nor am I going to sell my condominium." This statement drew anticipated boos and hisses from the audience. After gaining the undivided attention of his targeted audience, he outlined his counterproposal: to turn his condominium unit over to his company's profit-sharing and pension plan, and allow assembly line employees to use the unit as a vacation resort 52 weeks a year. He asked his audience, "Would that be okay with all you folks?" Numerous members of the audience moaned. They were undoubtedly envisioning Mr. W.'s blue-collar employees invading their space 52 weeks a year. Some attendees shouted out, "Keep the dog! Keep the dog!" The chairman of the Action Committee proposed that a committee meeting be held immediately in the adjoining conference room. 5 minutes after this behind-closed-doors meeting, the committee members filed back into the room. The chairman told the audience of condominium owners that the Action Committee had made a decision. After reviewing all the elements of this situation, the Action Committee recommends that the W's be allowed to keep their dog. I ask that the covenant be so amended. All in favor? Not long after this brilliant victory, the W's sold their condominium unit. They did so because, as Mr. W. observed, "I don't want to live in a building with people who don't like dogs." According to Mr. W., his dog was very important to him and his family, so much so that they sold the unit at a bargain price. They have sold other units in other complexes in which people were hostile to their dog. So how much is that doggie in the condominium worth? To the W's, it's worth several hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's how much he estimates he lost in selling his units at below true market value. A hostile environment, even in an atmosphere of beautiful people, is not a good place for dogs, or for prodigious accumulators of wealth.
The Millionaire Next Door, The Surprising Secrets of America's Wealthy, was written by Dr. Thomas Stanley and Dr. William Danko, and read by Cotter Smith. The recording engineers were Paul Fowley and Michael Jones, with editing and post-production by Lisa Bainey. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Jessica Cassidy. The directors were Karen Perlman and Sally Hurst. The Millionaire Next Door was produced by Sally Hurst. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Millionaire Next Door, The Surprising Secrets of America's Wealthy, is also available in book form from Pocket Books.